Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. And ladies and gentlemen, I would like to point out that Audrey, Mike, and Lucy did not take that five-day holiday. They came back tonight. Now, isn't that incredible? That's just great. Many people are still vacationing and watching football. Is there another football game on tonight, Audrey? I think there's probably about 20 on tonight, but I don't know about football. I like football, but I think you can develop a stress disorder from watching too much of it. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And I'm your host, Keith Haley. Thank Johnny Cash. By the way, it reminds me when he sings that song about hitchhiking and with the truckers, because I got a big dent in my automobile. Because some of the truckers in cold weather like this, where the snow and ice all kind of melted, then it froze. Here in Little Tiffin High, we're going to go down below zero tonight. And this truck came by, and that snow, you know, flew up and hit the side of my car. And it wasn't snow; it was real hard, solid ice, and put it in. And it wasn't enough to go get it fixed. But anyway, be careful out there, because there is some ice that will be flying around and slush tomorrow. That is not just slush; it will damage your vehicle. The purpose of our show is always to discuss news, issues, events, and developments in this interesting field of criminal justice and related fields. And I think tonight will be a good example of something. It was for me. We'll be talking about something that essentially few of us knew nothing about or know anything about. And it's called, the book we're going to be talking about with the author is Pat Cote. And he's author and vice president. He was a candidate with Ross Perot for president in 1996. And the book is called Hot Property: The Stealing of Ideas in the Age of Globalization. He goes back into the history, and even our founding fathers' time and on, about trademarks and patent thefts, to how that's hurting the United States, and I'll comment on this a little bit more before we listen to Mr. Cote. But a very interesting subject, and this goes on today, right now. I mean, we hear about all kinds of thefts and all sorts of things, but few of us know much about patents. trademark thefts and that type of thing. Very interesting business. We dedicate this show to our tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who, by the way, have been working through the holidays. We can't let the kids out of the juvenile institutions, the adults out of the prisons, and the cops have to patrol the streets at even in larger numbers and longer hours than they ever have. And let's don't forget the firefighters, a job I never wanted to have. To me, just about whatever we pay firefighters is worth it, because when you have that emergency, you want them to respond in their finest form, and they do. And I really admire volunteer firefighters who go through all that training and then get certified and do it for a very small amount of money. Okay, you're listening on Blog Talk Radio Network. We've told you before, Alan Levy is the genius of all this. He's the CTO of BTR, and you can have your own show if you want to do this. What a great thing to do in this time of New Year's resolutions. Do we still allow those? I've heard so many people talk on radio and television today about New Year's resolutions. I think I have New Year's resolution stress disorder. But anyway, this will be a good time to decide to do a radio show on something that nobody's doing. And there's all kinds of things you can do. You can write your own music and have a show, you know, every week or three nights a week, whatever. And you can broadcast absolutely free unless you're doing prime time, which is, I think, 7 to 10 p.m. I pay a little bit of money, not much, almost nothing, to do that. So these shows are also archived immediately for replay. A lot of people listen to those shows. Millions listen to our show. Is that right, Mike? Well, maybe not millions. It's the thousands. Well, maybe not thousands. No, it is several thousand, I think. Who knows? But anyway, it is archived, and you can get the things, and I think they're all on podcastdirectory.com also. Okay, we're going to take a little look tonight, a little look at some of the news and that type of business. We do have a blonde joke that we should do, because we've been doing, I know we haven't done 1,001 blonde jokes, or radio shows, excuse me, because I still have blanks in the book there. Is McFoy's book, 1,001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Let's get that blonde joke out of the way, planet-saving tip out of the way right now. And this is, I'll bet you never thought of this. Remember, we're trying to save the planet, and paper and all that stuff is, by the way, are light bulbs still legal after the January the 1st? Somebody told me they weren't even legal. Are we back to candles? Now would be a good time to invest in the candle industry. I think it's a certain type of bulb that's gone. We've gone through a couple phases of that, according to one of my colleagues. Instead of relying on disposable styrofoam or plastic cups at work, take in your own ceramic or china mug so you can sip with a free conscience. So you can sip with a free conscience. In other words, by the way, who would want to drink good tea or good coffee out of a paper or styrofoam cup anyway? It tastes awful. I've been carrying that mug for since the beginning of time. But anyway, that's a pretty good one. All right, let's do a blonde joke, and I'll spend a little time on the news. But I do want to have sufficient time tonight to listen to Mr. Coe talk about these patent and trademark thefts, et cetera. I think you'll find it very interesting. It's something that most of us know zip about, I suspect. All right, here we go with our blonde joke. There was a blonde who was just, she was sick and tired of all the blonde jokes. I don't blame them. One evening she went home and memorized all the state capitals. Back in the office the next day, some guy started telling a dumb blonde joke. She interrupted him with a shrill announcement. I've had it up to here with these blonde jokes. I want you to know that this blonde went home last night and did something probably none of you could do. I memorized all of the state capitals. I don't believe you, he says. What's the capital of Nevada? And she says, N. I like that one. She says, N. All right. She says, "Man, that's a good one." All right, that's enough for the blonde jokes. The Ohio Coalition, by the way, would like to remind you, if you have a firearm and you have a concealed carry license, they would like you to go down and turn in your firearms license and your gun. I think that's who this is directed at. Listen to this public service announcement we've been giving for years. I think that's their message.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is a deadly idea to carry that gun unless you use that firearm to ward off a felon, and nearly 300,000 people a year do that, and about 97% of those cases they don't shoot one time. All they do is pull it out and the attackers take off because they're at least smart enough to figure that out, so, you know, that a weapon could hurt them. So CCW is still a big topic. It's going on and on and on, and you see in the news, I won't comment on that one tonight, but there's some places now that are having registries now for businesses that have parts of the states or states are having registries for businesses that allow concealed carry or even open carry. And in other words, they're getting business based on that fact. And Starbucks was one of those places years ago when everybody thought Starbucks was over on the left side of the political spectrum. Starbucks says you can carry in here. We're not going to stop it, as a lot of businesses do. But anyway, that's an interesting idea. Let's go ahead and take a look at some of the news tonight. I think you'll find some interesting things in our news stories. Oh, this one I thought was incredible. Being a marathoner, ultra-marathoner, cross-state runner, etc., this headline has said, "Vegans powered by raw food complete year of daily marathons." This is a couple, and there's a picture of them in the news story in the British Telegraph newspaper. A couple in their 60s set a world record in Australia after running a marathon each day for 366 consecutive days. Janet Murray Wakelin and Alan Murray rose at 4 a.m. each day and ran 366 consecutive marathons with no days off. Now, those of you who don't know exactly what a marathon consists of, that is 26.2 miles. So every day for 1 year and one day, they ran a marathon. It's a couple in their 60s. They ran one each day and every day for the past year. Is that incredible? And their comments were, interesting, they're both vegans. The pair ate up to 30 bananas a day as they completed a trek of almost 10,000 miles around Australia. Janet Murray Wakelin, 64, and Alan Murray, 68, rose at 4 a.m. and ran 366 consecutive days, covering almost 10,000 miles as they ran around Australia and the island state of Tasmania. She said it was pretty hard when we first got started, but after we got going in a few weeks or something, it was almost nothing. She says, "You don't stop doing something that works," she says. She told the Fairfax media, adding she was not exhausted and she felt like she could run forever. Here's what they did exactly. They got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They ate 10 bananas. No, I'm not drinking. They ate 10 bananas and a grapefruit and a date smoothie for breakfast. I don't think I've ever had a smoothie. But anyway, then another 10 bananas at 8 a.m. So that's 20 bananas a day. A green smoothie at 9 a.m. A fruit salad at the 19-mile mark. 3 oranges at the 23 mark before finishing at 4 p.m. and eating an avocado, vegetable juice, and a salad for dinner. The run beat the world record set in 2011 by a Belgian man named Stefan Engels, who ran 365 marathons in a year. So they went one day farther than he did. Is that incredible? Just absolutely incredible that somebody could cover that distance. Do you see where the government is considering now putting the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, very important mission that agency has, is spending the next couple of weeks mulling over its decision to install vehicle-to-vehicle communications, known as V2V for short, into new vehicles. This would allow them to talk to each other through GPS data under the guise of accident prevention. A lot of folks are saying, including one in the government, he says, privacy is a real challenge here. This is refreshing honesty from a government official. He's from the Government Accountability Office. He says, you know, should the government know where we are every second with this GPS tracking vehicle? I thought they already knew because they could. There's something in there when you have an accident, but don't quote me on that. I'm not sure. And then they thought that, you know, maybe the next step is taxing drivers by every mile they drive. You know, we want to be sure that we can do that. And then you can mail them a ticket for things like speeding and that sort of stuff, just like we do with red light cameras. Of course, the cost for this technology will be tacked onto the price of new cars. Still, the government officials have something else to do. Can you imagine a bunch of cars trying to communicate with each other, and like on a snowy night, like it is here in Ohio tonight, and other parts of the country? That is weird. Well, I guess you know that Colorado has opened up to marijuana, and it's recreational marijuana. And I forget how many of these places they open up, but anyway, marijuana does not have to be a burden to communities, says Betty Holdworth, deputy director of the National Cannabis Industry Association. Today in Colorado, we shift marijuana, she says, from the underground into a regular market. I'm sure it will just stay in the regular market, aren't you, Mike? Lucy, what do you think? Altworth says pot sales in the state are expected to reach $400 million this year. Wonder how much it's going to reach out of state where they got the pot in in Colorado. Oh, more than $40 million in tax revenue is targeted for public schools. There you go. That's how to justify it. Let's smoke pot for the public schools. Have you seen some of the pictures of the folks already sitting around in circles, token off? Dozens of shops are opened or will open very soon. She spoke of jobs and tax dollars and peace of mind for the marijuana smokers. Well, unfortunately, that peace of mind sometimes shows up behind the driver's wheel. I mean, you can't be under the influence of the cannabis while you're driving and cause accidents. And they're saying that this is going to be a big experiment, Washington State. They'll begin allowing retail sale of marijuana this spring. But you watch and see, you're going to see some really crazy stuff, I will bet you. And the pot shops, they show one employee, they show them licking wrapping papers as they made joints. I don't know anything about it. I've never smoked that joint in my life. I can remember people doing it back in the Ice Age when I was a cop. But it's against the federal law, by the way. And the U.S. Justice Department is paying attention, but they've already decided they're going to sort of hang back on this. And they've outlined an 8-point slate of priorities for pot regulation, requiring states to keep the drug away from minors, to keep it away from criminal cartels, federal property in other states in order to avoid a federal crackdown. So now you're going to see big tourist trips, where people will be going to marijuana to kind of choke it out, right? So we'll have to see what happens. Some new laws. So this is the time a new law is going into effect, and we did have the one that said we all sleep a little bit better at night knowing that students in grades K through 12 who identify as transgender from kindergarten on up will be able to use the school bathrooms of their choosing. That's nice. I love that. On-campus smoking, this is University of California. Campuses told 10 of men wearing dresses to class, that's okay. That's no problem, they said, but you can't inhale a Camel cigarette while walking to your next exam. So you can't smoke at all on campus, even outside. That's going to be interesting. Even e-cigarettes, I don't know why anybody want to smoke those. But anyway, bicycles, you probably already heard the news people talking about that. But if you drive too close to a bicycle, not hit them, if you drive too close to a bicycle, you'll be fined for that. They don't. Oh, 3 feet from the cyclist while passing them. They have to be at least 3 feet away. But there'll be some arguments over that, won't there? Anyway, search warrants. How about this one? This might be renamed the vampire law. A driver suspected of DUI who refuses to submit to or fails to complete a blood test can be served a search warrant to draw blood in a reasonably medically approved manner. This law actually went into effect September 20th. So that is just absolutely incredible. What's going on here in Virginia? What was that one? We got time. Yeah, that's the pro-gun thing. I was going to talk about that already. Here is very good news. 2013, we have the fewest police deaths by firearms since 1887. I'm going to say that again. We have the fewest police deaths by firearms since 1887. The number of law enforcement officers killed by firearms in 2013 fell to levels not seen since the days of the Wild West. Isn't that great? According to the report, 111 state, federal, and local tribal and territorial officers were killed in the line of duty nationwide this past year, according to 121 in 2012. So that's good. 46 officers were killed in traffic-related accidents, and 33 were killed by firearms. So that is really good news. The states that had the highest number were Texas and California. Had the highest number of fatalities with 13 and 10 respectively, but you know, those are bigger states, so they're probably going to be the biggest. What do we got here? Oh, new Mayor de Blasio, who's changed his name, by the way. I read a little bit about him in a Wikipedia bio. Mayor-elect Blasio vows to act quickly to abolish the horse-drawn carriages in the city. So you can go, tourists go to Central Park and they get in a horse-drawn carriage and drive around. I don't know what that costs, probably more than most people wanted to pay, but he doesn't want to do that. And do you know what the reason is? Many people thought it would have to do with the manure or something like that. No, because they think it's cruel. We should have more compassion for the horses than the people that would be killed when he restricts the stop and frisk policy. So what's that mean? Oh, anyway, he thinks it's cruel to the horses. So that's very, very interesting. Oh, my gosh. Did you know that if you read a novel, it boosts your brain function? I'd love to deal with these two. Reading a gripping novel causes biological changes in the brain, which last for days as the mind is transported into the body of the protagonist. In other words, you become the protagonist by reading the novel, and your brain function increases for X number of days after that. So all of you start reading a novel, let me know next week when you're doing that. I've never written a novel. I've written a whole bunch of other things, but I've never done a novel. I've had two students have done it, actually, and interesting novels, both of them. What's this one about? Oh, I can't deal with that one. Here's one. I'll finish with this. I'm operating from another stress disorder, all the New Year's resolutions about exercise and diet. And I'm trying to help you. You can go to archive.org and type in the three-bowl diet, and you can have Audrey, yes, our Audrey, read you the book, The Three-Bowl Diet, that I wrote. You and I were the last people in the world that hadn't written a diet book. So I went ahead and wrote mine. And I put it on archive.org, and it's absolutely free, and you can listen to it. Or you could go to Amazon.com and actually buy the book. Now, I don't know. I don't want you to do that because we're not going to get rich. But the theme of the book is move more, eat less. I think people have been knowing about that since the beginning of time. I saw somebody on television today show us how to get down in a push-up position for our New Year's exercise programming. And don't do the push-up. Just go down a little bit and hold that for like 5 seconds or something like that and then come back. They actually had this guy on television twice. He was talking about, fat foods can hurt you, but protein foods will allow you to gain less weight or maintain your weight. I think if you go to Google Books and you go back and look at something called like isometrics, you can see that people build up their muscles by that pressure isometrics back in the 1880s and 1890s. It's not something new. But I tell you, if I see another diet program, I think I'm going to flip out. But what this article says, if you take 2,000 extra steps a day, it can help your heart and stroke. And, by doing 4,000 extra steps, 40 minutes, 20 minutes is about a mile. 40 minutes would be like 2 miles. You can do that. By the way, I got some new Timberland hiking boots, and Been doing some hiking in the woods, and boy, I tell you, they are, Timberland makes some good stuff. They're waterproof. No, they're not sponsoring the program, Mike. Okay. But anyway, yeah, get out there and walk. Nothing is better than walking, and people that know that already were years ahead of us, I think. And what did the American Indian, I don't know what tribe said, they said that your legs are your doctor. That means get out there and walk. Okay, one of the things I wanted to mention tonight, you know how you know stuff that you found out about you didn't know for years that everybody else knew about? That's true of everybody. I mean, there's something you don't know that we know, and we know something that you don't know, and vice versa. But anyway, I just sort of discovered these Celestial Seasonings teas. They make like 72 different flavors of tea. Did you ever see these in Kroger's and IGA and Meyer and all these places? Celestial Seasonings teas, they're from Boulder, Colorado. And you can buy sampler packs. I don't know how much they cost, $4 or something like that. You get in them like four or five raspberry zingers, or you can get Country Fresh Peach. You can get Wild Berry Zinger. You can get True Blueberry. These are all in one box, or Black Cherry Berry. And I just had a Black Cherry Berry before the show here today. I mean, these things are excellent. And then there's a whole bunch of sampler boxes. Then you can get the one that's got, chamomile in it that helps you sleep. And then another one's called Sleepy Time. And but they got, in this company, their blend master writes a little message on the side of their master blend master. He writes a little thing on the side of the box. And what he does is that he talks about, you can actually come, you go to their website, Celestial Seasonings, just Google it. And it's Boulder, Colorado. I wonder which sells better, the marijuana or the teas. But anyway, they actually have tours there. You can eat in their restaurant and all kinds of things. But I didn't know the first doggone thing about Celestial Seasonings teas, but it looks like a real high-quality company and a very good product. I've tasted about 9 or 10 of their bought a couple of the boxes, and I've got 9 or 10 of them, and they are really, really nice, very relaxing, and very, very tasty. Well, enough of that. Shut up, right? Okay, I'll actually do that. What we want to do tonight is listen to Mr. Pat Coate. And Pat Coate ran for vice president with Ross Perot, who ran Perot Systems and all kinds of things down in Plano, Texas. And Ross Perot, of course, is a self-made multi-millionaire, and I imagine Pat Coate is doing pretty well himself. But anyway, he wrote the book called Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in the Age of Globalization. You can find this on C-SPAN Video Library. I find those things for you, and then we get them started, and then you can listen to the rest of it later on. But let's go ahead and listen to him talk about this very interesting idea of what's going on in the world. And what is going on is that people are stealing patents and trademarks and all kinds of things, and it's really hurting our own industrial base. It's hurting creativity in the United States, and it's been going on since colonial times. Here we go. Give me time to get it set up.
Third of all compact discs sold last year were pirated, amounting to a loss of $4.6 billion to the recording industry. In Hot Property, author Pat Choate looks at the history of piracy since the 1800s. The program is just over an hour.
Okay, good evening, folks. Well, we're ready to begin. Welcome to Politics and Prose Bookstore. I'm Mike Giratano, and I for the staff and the owners here at the store, I thank you for coming in and joining us this evening. We welcome Pat Choate tonight. He's a historian, a political economist, a think tank strategist, and a policy analyst. This is his fourth time speaking at the store. This time around, he's here for his latest book, Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. He will speak for about 20 minutes to a half hour, and then we'll have time for questions, which we will field from our audience microphone. If you could get to that, it would be convenient to keep the talk audible. Hot Property addresses intellectual property rights from their inclusion in the U.S. Constitution to the current attack they're under by theft and piracy. This is negatively impacting the U.S. economy, risking health and safety, and thinning creativity, innovation, and authenticity. Ultimately, there is a dire role to be played by the U.S. government in taking more competitive measures to protect our interests. Again, thanks for coming in this evening, Pat Cho.
Mike, thank you very much, and thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to be back at Politics as Pros. I'm, like many of you, have seen this door grow from across the street here and bigger and bigger, and that is a pleasurable. I'm going to start off with just making a few personal observations. Writing books for me is in many ways a painful pleasure, I call it. Eventually the work is done, the last corrected galley is sent back to the publisher, and then there's a period of several months between the time that the galley is in and it's being printed, and you get the first copy of the book, and there's almost a postpartum depression as a writer of, you know, that part of your life is over as you think about what your next book will be. But it's also a period of time that gives the author an opportunity to reflect on just what the book is about. What did I just spend 3 or 4 years on? What's it about? And I've done that with this book. And hopefully, I think this book is a strong and well-documented advocacy for strong intellectual property laws, not only in the United States, in the world. These protections are the very foundation of our economy. They're the principal means that we have to stimulate innovation and ideas in our country. The new ideas and the innovations that flow from these protections have profoundly shaped the lives of the American people in this country for almost 200 years. They've enabled the United States to achieve an extraordinary standard of living, maintain our national security, and assist people everywhere enjoy a better life. Now, despite that importance, and it is important, as I think I described, what we also find is, I think at first glance, most people think of intellectual property as a truly dull but important DBI, that standard that affects so many public policy issues. It certainly, in practice, it's technical. It involves complex legal concepts. It is deeply mired in obscure politics. It is dominated by people and bureaucratic organizations known primarily to the lawyers, bureaucrats, and technicians. Or put it another way, very few children in America grow up wanting to be a corporate intellectual property counsel. This is not high on their list. The question for a writer, the question for me in doing this, is how do you take an important topic where there is maybe a bit of prejudice against it as being interesting, and how do you make it an interesting subject for the reader? How do you give access to the reader? Well, the answer, of course, is stories. You tell stories of artists and inventors and musicians and other creative people. It's their experiences that are fascinating and sometimes odd. Sometimes, as you will find in the book, some of these stories are almost unbelievable. For example, Thomas Edison hired a pseudoscientist to publicly electrocute large dogs and horses to scare the public away from George Westinghouse's alternating current electric system. He wound up with a situation in New York State where Edison was financing efforts to electrocute criminals as a means of discrediting Westinghouse, and you wound up with George Westinghouse financing the legal appeals for everyone on death row. That's odd. The Cunard Shipping Company put a fourth funnel on the Titanic, a fake funnel on the Titanic, to make the public think the ship was as fast and as sophisticated as its German rivals. Eli Whitney got a contract to produce 10,000 muskets, though he had no experience, none, in making arms. He had no factory. He had no machinery. He had no workers, and he was bankrupt. He promised delivery within 2 years, but ten years to do his contract, a precedent for some other defense contracts. He falsified his progress reports, tricking Presidents Adams and Jefferson into thinking he was producing interchangeable parts when he was not, though he eventually did. Despite all of that, you wound up with Eli Whitney inventing interchangeable parts, the assembly line of manufacturing, and he totally changed manufacturing in the history of the world. Alexander Graham Bell made one great invention in his life, and it was the telephone. It is considered the most perfect patent ever written. It is the most profitable patent ever written. Yet Bell's application reached the patent office only 2 hours before an application from Elijah Gray, a prominent Chicago inventor, who sued Bell repeatedly until Gray died. One associate of Elijah Gray said of him that of all the people who did not invent the telephone first, Gray was the closest. It took the patent office only 3 weeks to review and approve Bell's patent. The Bell patent was challenged in 600 lawsuits, five of which went to the Supreme Court. Bell won every suit. Alexander Graham Bell's story, let me clear my throat, is also one of America's great love stories. And I tell this in this book. Bell's sponsor, Bell, who came to the United States from Scotland and to Canada, his two brothers had died of tuberculosis, and he had to leave Edinburgh, he thought, to survive. He came from a very distinguished family of educators. Bell's great sponsor in the United States was a man now forgotten named Gardner Hubbard. Hubbard had hired Bell to come to Boston to run the school for the deaf and to teach his deaf teenage daughter. And eventually, the 19-year-old Mabel Hubbard and 27-year-old Alexander Graham Bell fell in love, and they married. On their wedding night, Bell, as his gift to his bride, gave her every share of stock in the Bell Telephone Company, all of his shares. Now, what makes that extraordinary is her father was a manager. He ran the Bell Company. He was very clever and a very astute businessman. Bell cared nothing for the business. He wanted to teach deaf children. But what happened is when Gardner Hubbard died, the stock went to Mabel Hubbard. Mabel Hubbard was the largest single stockholder in the Bell Telephone Company, and she could never use the phone because she was deaf. An interesting, irony of history. Hubbard invented franchising in America. The first Bell Company was set up on a model that McDonald's would later use in fast food. And it worked just fabulously. The greatest monument to Hubbard that we see nationally is Hubbard founded the National Geographic Society. And it was Alexander Graham Bell, after Hubbard died, who took over the responsibilities. And at that point, he really wanted someone to run the National Geographic. And he had a friend who was a diplomat who had two 21-year-old sons. He invited the 21-year-old sons to join them in Canada for 6 weeks in the summer. One of the sons wanted to run the National Geographic. He also wanted to marry Bell's daughter, and that was the beginning of the National Geographic. Now, in writing the book, I divided it into three parts. The first section explains the history of the patent system, its value to the nation, and its abuse by pirates and counterfeiters. The second section explains how Germany used innovation and patents to become, in the late 19th and early century, to become a great world power. It describes how Japan did the same thing in the middle 20th century, and it analyzes how China is doing the same thing today. Now, let me just start with some basics on the intellectual property system. This is I'll try not to make this dull because I want to go back to a bunch of stories that I want to share with you. First of all, ideas are the foundation on which patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets are created. They're the purest product of the mind. They're the greatest, most stable source of the wealth of nations. The knowledge that flows from ideas is the dominant, if not the only, competitive source of advantage. They're intangible. They're ephemeral. Yet they're the wellspring of creativity. Ideas cannot be owned, but producing the creations that flow from them can be property, with all the rights bestowed on property owners, at least for a set period of time. Intellectual property law is about classifying the form an idea takes, the right to exclude others from its use, the enforcement of that right, the penalties for any infringement of that right, the assignment of responsibility for imposing the punishment, and equally important to all of that, the attendant obligation of the intellectual property owner to the larger society to share knowledge. Now, with potential so vast, this is an area of enormous amounts of pirating and counterfeiting. The way that I view, and I think the way the founding fathers viewed intellectual property, is that it is a social contract between society and creative people. It's a golden covenant. It is a golden covenant by which the public grants someone the right to exclude others from using their creation for a specified period of time in exchange for the creative person disclosing the details of their creation and ultimately surrendering that creation to enter the public domain where everyone can use and build on the knowledge. It is knowledge for exclusive use. Ultimately, that is the golden covenant. Now, the hope of the golden covenant is by making that grant is the general state of knowledge will be advanced. That has worked wonderfully well in the United States. In the United States, the protections of that right flows directly from the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 grants Congress the power, quote, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times and authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. This idea was so firmly held by the founding fathers that at the Constitutional Convention there was no debate and this provision was passed on a unanimous vote. Moreover, this is the only place in the body of the Constitution where the term right is explicitly mentioned. The constitutional amendments that became known as the Bill of Rights were not ratified until almost the end of the third year of George Washington's first presidential term and almost 19 months after the passage of the first Patent and Copyright Acts in 1790. This 27-word clause is the legal basis for every patent and every copyright ever issued in the United States. Over time, four types of basic intellectual property protections have been created: patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade law. And in the book, I trace out the history of each one, and it's a raucous history, let me assure you. Trademarks were first developed in the 1870s, and the great promoters of trademarks were the producers of bourbon. Literally, what was happening is people were producing bourbon to unsophisticated drinkers that tasted alike, and so they differentiated by the shape of the bottles and the labels, et cetera. Other parts of our intellectual property system have almost the same interesting background. Now, all of that said, let's get back to the stories. I begin the first chapter with the inauguration of George Washington, and it's a fitting beginning. April 30th, 1789, downtown New York City. City Hall suddenly became the capital of the United States, noon. And what was interesting is when George Washington appeared. George Washington is presented as a very dour man in our history, chopping a cherry tree, wooden teeth, etc. George Washington was, in many ways, anything but that. He was a fascinating man. He was a rich planner. He was a surveyor. He was a soldier. He had his suits made in London by custom tailors out of silk and velvet. George Washington was the ultimate partygoer. George Washington was known at Mount Vernon for giving dances where he would dance all through the night. One of the things that he did all through the Revolutionary War, he imposed a fee on all of his officers so they could do three social events throughout the year to build a spree. But given all of that, an extraordinary thing happened when he was inaugurated in 1789. He showed up in a brown suit of homespun broadcloth, a gift from the Hartford Woolen Manufactory, a small mill in Connecticut. Every item that he wore, his shoes, his belt, the buttons on his jacket, his suit had been made in the United States. He came there and did that to make a personal gesture for the need for America to create a strong domestic manufacturing base. As a general who led the fighting during the Revolution, Washington knew that the war had almost been lost several times because of the lack of materials during the war. America had been a colony. It had won its hard-won freedom just barely. At Bunker Hill, the soldiers only had 9 rounds of ammunition. The American soldiers finished the Battle of Bunker Hill using their muskets as clubs on the British. In Valley Forge, and the winner of Valley Forge, one of the famous letters of Washington to the Congress, is that literally he had 2,500 troops out of commission because they lacked shoes, shirts, or blankets. Now, an indication of the dependence and the situation that the founding fathers faced and why they became so intent on creating a manufacturing base and having intellectual property rights to stimulate it is found in Benjamin Franklin's list of purchases in France when he went there to try to buy the tools of war. What he bought was 80,000 shirts, 80,000 blankets, 100 tons of gunpowder, 8 ships of the line, muskets, and 100 artillery pieces. Then Franklin had to arrange for the whole thing to be passed a British naval blockade that involved half the British Navy, a 4,000-mile, 3-month journey to the Caribbean, where the goods then had to be transshipped or transpacked to smugglers, who then brought it into the colonies on a 1,400-mile trip that took another 6 weeks. Not surprisingly, Washington's first priority was to develop American industries. In his first State of the Union message, he called for a patent and a copyright act. And among the first legislation the first Congress passed was the Patent and Copyright Act. In April and May of 1790, those laws were passed. Moreover, the issuance of a patent was made in the highest order of the state. The patent board consisted of the Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of War Henry Knox, and Attorney General Edmund Randolph. The three met on the last Saturday of every month. The three voted favorably. A patent letter was presented for George Washington's signature. Once signed by the President, the Secretary of State signed the letter. He affixed the great seal of the United States, and the cost of the inventor was $5. And that money went to the clerk who embossed this. There were 57 of those patents issued in 2 years. If you happen to have one of those patent applications, just for the signatures on, it is an important historical artifact. really what happened, and it was one of great mortification for Jefferson, the patent board couldn't meet their duty. They were surprised. They figured if they offered a golden covenant, you'd have people want to take it. They were surprised by the number of people. There was a latent creativity. Though they issued 57, they wound up with over 200 applications. It overwhelmed them. And so what happened is the Congress made a shift into the patent laws. Instead of having a patent system of very tight controls, in 1793, they set up a patent system of very weak controls. They set up a system where literally all that an inventor had to do was go to the federal court and register the patent. If there were a conflict, they'd let the federal courts and lawsuits sort it out. So suddenly you had hundreds of patent applications coming in, many for the same invention, and the courts immediately became clogged with lawsuits. Now, for Alexander Hamilton and others of that era, that was not an undesirable outcome. Hamilton, in his report on manufacturing, laid out a strategy where the United States would go out and seek and get, even steal, the best technologies in the world. And so a system was set up at that particular point that, in effect, with those weak laws, made the United States the great pirating and counterfeiting haven of the world. In the first 50 years of America's existence, we did not issue a single patent to a foreigner. In the first 101 years of our existence, we did not issue a single copyright to a foreigner. We literally were a pirate haven. But what we did is in less than a year, we went from an agricultural former colony to the greatest industrial power in the world. So I point that out to only say that we have no moral advantage when we talk about other countries stealing technology or engaged in piracy, et cetera. What we need to do is recognize this is a natural course of development. Now, one of the things I do is I illustrate the consequences of a loose patent system by telling the story of Eli Whitney, who invented the cotton gin in mass production manufacturing. This is not the story we learned in college. It is not a mythical story. It is one of the things that you learn is that Whitney truly had a co-inventor. It was Catherine Greene, the widow of General Nathaniel Greene, the Revolutionary War hero. During the war, General Greene, who was one of Washington's favorites and an heir to a Rhode Island fortune, had liquidated his entire fortune, including selling his home, to feed, arm, and clothe his troops. And though he did that, Congress quibbled with him about the nature of his receipts and refused to pay him. Now, the state of Georgia, which Greene had liberated from the British, was more grateful. It gave the destitute general after the war, Mulberry Grove, the estate of a displaced Tory who had left the state. After the war, the 44-year-old Greene, who refused to own slaves, he was a Quaker, worked himself to death, and he died of a heat stroke, leaving his 31-year-old widow and five children with a debt-ridden plantation. By borrowing money, she kept the plantation alive, even as she petitioned Congress for her husband's expenses. Finally, she got the money through a special act of Congress through the help of President George Washington. Enter Eli Whitney. In 1793, he's a graduate of Yale University. He has a teaching job set up in New York City. The job disappears. It turns out that a former graduate of Yale and now the overseer of Mulberry Grove is seeking a tutor to assist a large plantation owner in South Carolina. Whitney, like most college graduates then and now, was deeply in debt. He took the job. So the overseer said, why don't you come down from New Haven to New York and take the ship with Mrs. Green and myself from here to Savannah. Whitney agreed. He went down there. Well, it turns out it was an absolute nightmare, and it fits into the story. On the first leg of the trip from Connecticut to New York City, Whitney's ship floundered at Hell's Gate, 6 miles from his destination, and most of the passengers made it ashore. The passengers then took a wagon into town. When Whitney got to town, he saw an old friend. He rushed up, shook his hands, before realizing that the man had an active case of smallpox, which at that time had a fatality rate of 30%. Catherine Green, a very can-do person, she merits a movie on her own. She's just terrific. She took charge. She had Whitney inoculated with a small amount of smallpox spores, which he actually got the disease. That reduced his odds to 1 in 100. He survived, and he only had 14 pockmarks, but he had to be kept in isolation for 2 weeks. After the 2 weeks, they took the trip from New York to Savannah, and, of course, Whitney was seasick the whole time. And as a result of this, Catherine Green invited him to come to her plantation with her family for a few days. He went there. And as a gift to her, she did needlepoint. She made a tambour. It's a frame to do needlepoint. And it was very neatly done. Seeing his cleverness, Catherine Green asked him, almost as a lark, can you invent something that would remove the seed from cotton fiber? Cotton fiber was an exotica. It's been around for 3,000 years. The Egyptians used it. It was used in the South America. It was called the vegetable cloth. To put it in context, at that point in time, only 4% of cloth used in Britain and elsewhere was made of cotton. It was a very valuable thing. Most of the cloth was made out of wool. He took a look at the challenge. Now, this had been a challenge that existed for 3,000 years. He had a flash, an inspiration. He said, yeah, he could do it. In 10 days, he not only figured out how to do it, the basic part of it, he built an operating model. The model itself could do the work of 50 men pulling.
We're going to have to stop there, but I think you probably enjoyed his presentation to this point, and he gets into the theft and other things. We're about half done with that, but you can go to C-SPAN Video Library and type in Hot Property, and this thing will come up, and the whole presentation is about 1 hour and 6 minutes long. So hope you enjoyed that. Very interesting ideas about what country is better at inventing things in the United States. I mean, we have an environment still that permits that and promotes that. So anyway, we'll see you next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn here sign us off with her usual song, We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know where.